Welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. And this is one of the interviews that I am the most excited about. It's with Nikki Gratterix, who is going to be talking about adverse childhood experiences, really how childhood, big traumas, small traumas, what happens when we're younger, the enormous impact that can have on the trajectory of not just our lives more generally, but specifically our health and the key role it can play in fatigue. So I'm excited for this conversation, partly because it's a fascinating and crucial topic, but also Nikki and I have known each other for a very long time. Nikki's probably worried what I'm going to say at this point, so I shall choose my words carefully. But Nikki played a crucial role in co-founding the Optimum Health Clinic. We've known each other since then, and I think part of what's fascinating for me about this conversation is Nikki was working on the nutrition side. She founded the nutrition department at the Optimum Health Clinic. I was working primarily on the psychology side, although also working with her on the development of the organization. And it's kind of ironic at this point that I'm doing all these interviews on functional medicine, and then I'm interviewing Nikki around the psychology piece. That tickles me a little bit. It's a funny kind of how things evolve. To give Nikki's professional bio before I welcome her, Nikki is an award-winning nutritional therapist, functional medicine practitioner, and transformation coach, helping people to optimize energy. In 2004, she co-founded the Optimum Health Clinic, one of the world's leading integrative medicine clinics specializing in fatigue-related conditions. The results of work there were published in the British Medical Journal Open, a prospective preliminary study in 2012. And in August 2015, she hosted the largest ever free online health summit on overcoming fatigue, interviewing 29 world-leading experts on optimizing energy with over 30,000 attendees. Nikki's also played, I should say, a crucial role in helping bring together this online conference. So in some ways, this is the kind of part two or evolution of what Nikki did originally. That's probably enough introduction. Nikki, welcome. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Alex, for being here. It's good fun to be here, and yeah, it's good to have a role reversal happening.
Yeah, and it's also, I guess, interesting that last time you were doing specifically an online conference on fatigue, you were asking the questions. So
yes,
there's quite a lot of role reversals and switches that are happening here. But let's open up at the beginning for people that haven't heard the term adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs as they're sometimes called. What do we mean by that?
Okay, I'll just take a step back. We sort of have this larger perception. I think most people understand that stress is a life-shortening experience. It's a very anti-health, so stress is bad for you. But what most people don't realize is that the majority of stress that we experience originates in childhood, and we'll talk about this. It also, what happens in childhood sets us up for how we perceive events in adulthood as well, whether we have resilience or not. So that's why people often ask me, you're always talking about childhood experiences, and the reason is that it sets you up for how you're going to respond to stress in adulthood as well. So it's really vital. And I'm not minimizing or playing down trauma or stress that can happen in adulthood as well, obviously, so that's important, but the early life experience is absolutely critical. So let's talk a little bit about adverse childhood events. That term came from some famous, very important studies. I think the most important study done in medicine is the adverse childhood event study. It was done by the CDC and Kaiser Permanente back in the mid-1990s, and they were surveying over 17,500 adults. And they're asking some very simple questions about people's early life experience, and then they correlated with adult onset chronic complex illness. And the results were profound and stunning, and the researchers weren't expecting it. And it instigated a whole sort of explosion in research in that area. So, for example, they found that 80% of everybody had at least one ACE, one adverse childhood event. If you had a moderate level, say six ACEs, and we'll talk about what they are, by the way, in a second. If you had six ACEs, that's a 20-year reduction in lifespan. If you had a high level of ACEs, you have an increased risk of 8 out of the top 10 causes of death, the dramatic increased risk. So this is huge, and we'll talk about the correlation with things like chronic fatigue. Essentially, if you have, it's like the poster child really for adverse childhood events, is how I looked at it and how I got into this work. If you have early life stress, you have a six-fold increased risk of chronic fatigue syndrome in adulthood. It was the same with fibromyalgia as well. So we'll talk more, but okay, so what is an ACE? I'll just jump ahead. You know, you would have jumped in and asked me that. What are we talking about? This is not an exhaustive list. This, the 10 categories the researchers came up with that was kind of a little bit ad hoc. It's things like parents separating and divorce, physical, sexual or emotional abuse, physical or emotional neglect, domestic violence, mental illness in the family, substance abuse or incarceration by a family member. So those were the 10. And the one thing I would just say about those 10, I've interviewed world leading experts on trauma who were very aware about that study. And they said it was the tip of the iceberg. The results, just the tip of the iceberg, because people were not able to often self-report they'd had trauma in childhood because it was actually very superficial questions. So for example, most people think trauma is things like being, you know, big things like being in a natural disaster or being in a car accident, things where there was a real or perceived threat to your physical body, well-being and life. Now, in early life stress, the majority of it, it does not qualify for PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. It's the much more subtle, ongoing attachment relationships. It's the relation, it's relational trauma. The majority of trauma from childhood is how you are getting on with your key caregivers. And so it's not these sort of external events, these discrete events like being hospitalization with an illness, something like that, which can be very traumatizing as well. And it's not to minimize PTSD, and that's very important and it has a big impact. It's just that it's not the majority, it's the minority. And it's this relational trauma, which is much more subtle, that, you know, and you might look back in your childhood and go, well, I think I had a pretty good childhood and there wasn't any physical abuse, there was no sexual abuse. And it's that invisible emotional neglect. We have an epidemic of emotional trauma, emotional neglect, and it's much bigger than people realize. And very few people are getting out of their childhood without being impacted by some level of trauma.
And as you remember, when we used to talk about this without the depth of understanding that I know you've gone into over subsequent years, you talked about this years ago at the Optimum Health Clinic, we used to talk about trauma with a big T and trauma with a small T, like those kind of big events that it's kind of clear and obvious. But these subtle kind of traumas, as you're describing, in a strange way can be more damaging, I think, because they don't get labeled and picked up in the same way at the time, right?
That's absolutely the case. It's people are getting to adulthood. They know there's something wrong, there's something not quite right. And until they start to learn about, for example, the symptoms of emotional neglect or some of these other kind of more relational attachment trauma aspects, until they learn about that in adulthood, they didn't know they'd experienced trauma. You know, it's even things like, you know, a continual withdrawal of love from a parent who's not expressive, or being shunned at school, being bullied at school, some of these sort of more sort of subtle things, which changes how the child perceives themselves, how they feel about themselves, and their core sense of safety, and the kind of the emotional diet that they learn to cultivate, that they take into adulthood, it gets set up in these early, very imprintable stages. When the brain is the most imprintable is when we're below age 18, and the brain's still evolving and growing. So that's why it's so critical. And you know, a lot of people, there's a lot of attachment trauma that happens before the age 4, which is before the cognitive brain even comes online. Only about 50% of children bond with the key caregiver if below age 4, only 50%, which is incredible. That's mainstream research backing it up. So how could you even self-report that if it's before kind of age 4? And so you might not remember there was trauma, but your body remembers. Professor Bessel van der Kolk's book is called The Body Keeps the Score. Time doesn't heal. Time doesn't heal, it conceals. So there's a whole set of changes that happens when we have this. So we'll talk more about that as well.
I think one of the things that has happened numerous times over the years with my patients, and I'm sure it's been true with yours as well, is that it's only when they do an in-depth clinical questionnaire that they're asked to answer these questions to describe, you know, what happened when you were this age, what were the key things here, what was your relationship like with your parents, that it's only in right answering those questions that it can be quite an emotionally impactful experience to suddenly realize the kind of number of things that happened which actually were quite damaging in their own way.
Yes, exactly. And some of the experts in trauma, they took the ACEs questionnaire, which is quite superficial, and actually changed the questions to ask more things like, who was there to take care of you when bad things happened? Who asked you how you were feeling? This kind of thing. And that's when people they couldn't finish the questionnaires, they couldn't finish the interviews because they were in such emotional traumas. You know, they were sad about discovering that, so they would actually leave the room. And that's something that's also, by the way, it's very interesting about relational trauma. It trumps PTSD. That's a really key finding. So bad things happen to all of us. It's part of life. But if you have strong social relations, if you had a good connection, you felt you belonged, you're part of the tribe. I'd say this is even evolutionary biology. If you think how important the tribe was thousands of years ago, like if you got rejected, just, you know, shunned, that meant death. So that's how important our social relations are. If you have good, solid social relations, when a discrete bad event happens, you are much less likely to develop PTSD in response to that if there's good social support. So this is something the trauma experts are coming out with and pointing out, that this kind of relational trauma is very different from PTSD. It also leads on to different symptoms as well, which we can talk more about.
Well, I think one of the strongest predictors of one's relationship to their own emotions and their own feelings, their own symptoms, is how did their parents relate to them, right? Like we internalize and we model the relationship of how those relate to us to then how we relate to ourselves. And as we're working with people to get better at listening to their body, to get better at pacing, to start to feel their feelings, we have to often unpack some of that, those relationships.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. That they're our role model, and how they relate to themselves is often what we pick up at a young age. We absorb that. So that whole process is key. But a couple of other statistics. If you had just four ACEs, you had a 400% increased risk of Alzheimer's and dementia. You had just two ACEs, you have 100% increased risk of autoimmune disease. In fact, autoimmune disease is as strongly correlated in women. ACEs and having autoimmune disease in adulthood is strongly correlated as smoking and lung cancer for women. So it's absolutely huge. Four ACEs also means you're 12 times more likely to be suicidal and attempt suicide. I'm saying it's across the board. I just want people to know that. If you have eight ACEs, it's triple the risk of lung cancer and 3.5 times the risk of heart disease. So the reason I'm sharing all that data is that so people understand the mind and the body are really one thing. You can't take the human body out of the social context. And what's happening in somebody's life, everything from who they perceive they are, how they relate to themselves, how they relate to other people, is being translated into the body. It's like your cells are listening to you, and that this evidence, there's the evidence that that's the case. And I think it's good for people to know who are on the chronic fatigue spectrum. This is not this old thing of saying, oh, you're making this up, and we're all talking about this being just a psychological thing. I'm saying, no, look, this is absolutely organic. This has a gigantic impact on your biochemistry, as well as your neurology, as well as your psychology. So that it's this idea that we're just saying, you know, this is all psychological. No, then you don't understand trauma, really.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
In fact, absolutely. In fact, I was asked a question a while ago on one of the Facebook lives that I do, and someone was saying, what's the difference between what you're saying and this being psychosomatic? And I said, well, if you've had a limb amputated and you have pain in a limb, what's called phantom limb pain, that is psychosomatic. There is no limb there that can have pain, but you're still firing responses in your brain, which tells you that there's pain. So there's no real mechanism there. That's very different to what we'll come to in a second, is that there are actual, it's not that the trauma means you're making it up. The trauma impacts the body, and the body therefore creates a set of symptoms which then result in what we're going to talk about. So do you want to talk a bit about how does childhood biography become adult biology. That's your phrase that I stole, by the way, but it's a great phrase.
Actually, I think it came from Caroline Miss, who came out with that phrase. Right. Yes.
Okay. Well, I was going to give you credit, so.
No. So yeah, how does this translate? So when the ACES study came out, it obviously triggered a huge amount of research, and people wanted to know what was actually happening. What's the mechanism? How can this dramatically increase the risk of all these chronic complex illnesses? So one of the early studies they found is that when we have this relational trauma, which is basically stressful on the small child brain, it changes the expression of the glucocorticoid receptors. That was the first sort of gene expression that shifted, which means that there was an epigenetic shift in how we respond to stress for the rest of our lives. So there was a reduced threshold of what would cause us to feel stress. So now we're sensitized. That's the definition of sensitized, reduced threshold of what causes us to have a stress response. So they actually did this experiment with rats, and the rats that didn't get the nurturing pup, you know, mother nurturing them, had an increased stress response for the rest of their life. And then they replicated that and found it to be true in humans as well, obviously. So that was the first one. Then other researchers came out and said, listen, it changes the entire epigenetic expression towards all these chronic complex illnesses. So from the date that this trauma, this disconnection, this feeling isolated and not feeling loved and welcomed into the world, whatever the event was, conscious or unconscious, the genetic expression changes. But also, if you separate, they've done it in rats, mice, and monkeys. Unfortunately, I don't agree with those experiments, but they've recreated separation trauma. The gut changes from the days that the child is taken away from the mum. So you've got gut dysbiosis and changes in the microbiota that happen from the date the trauma starts, an entire change of the genetic expression. We have this area of science called psychoneuroimmunology. It's about 30 years worth of research now. And one of the most robust findings is that this kind of social stress, it suppresses your immune system. So we've got changes in the gut, suppression of the immune system. By the way, your endocrine is going to change. It's going to affect the hormones. You know, we're going to have maybe increased cortisol, and at the cost of maybe the sex hormones. So all of these, it's a cascade of changes that stress and emotional trauma affects the entire biology. We're also discovering now that it will also cause mitochondrial dysfunction. We have this new area of research in chronic fatigue called the cell danger response, the CDR response, where the mitochondria, it turns out they don't just do energy work. They're also looking around and checking for threats. And Robert Navier, who did that work, has absolutely said early life stress, it's in his science paper, he said that early life stress is one of the factors that will trigger the cell danger response. So there we have it. That it explains everything we see in chronic fatigue can be triggered by stress and emotional trauma. And these changes that start happening from a young age, you know, the body's shifting without maybe us even being aware of it. And then we have a trigger in adulthood, but actually your system was set up to, you know, respond to that trigger and perhaps into illness. It started many years before for most people. So that's the effect on the biochemistry. It's very important. Yeah.
No, I was going to say that just to go back to where we were a few minutes ago, where people are, how does this affect the body? I mean, that's an unbelievably compelling list of impacts of childhood experiences on adult health and development. But I know you're not done, so let's come to the effects on neurology.
Yes, we've got, we'll talk about the effect on neurology and the effect on the psyche, the psychology. So the effects on the neurology are really important, because this early life stress will literally retrain the brain, the neural pathways, to be in more of this fight flight stress response. It actually would lead to a term that it was actually Professor Leonard Jason sort of came up with the phrase. He didn't come up with it, but he's talked about it in the context of chronic fatigue, limbic kindling, which is the idea of the brain being oversensitized, and then it's going to lead to inflammation. Absolutely, early life stress leads to brain inflammation. So now we have kindling in the brain, and this wired for stress, basically, which means that less has to happen to cause us to have a brain response. And now we're building neural pathways that kind of become that unconscious pattern of being in a chronic fear state, for example. So we're primed for that. So early life trauma will prime us for this kind of neurological limbic kindling and an oversensitized amygdala. So that's the kind of the key on the neurological side, which becomes then very important as well. And we also, I could mention, you would down-regulate the vagus nerve and the rest, digest, detoxify, parasympathetic side of the nervous system is all permanently downregulated. And we'll talk more about the vagus nerve, but the vagus nerve is the healing state. When you have strong vagal tone, that is the definition of a healing state. And if you have that turned off, turned down, downregulated epigenetically, because your brain is now neural, you have neural pathways toning that down, you have dramatic increased propensity for coming down with chronic illness in adulthood. So neurological, very important.
And I think just to comment on it as well, that you see this quite often in the whole spectrum of fatigue related cases, that as you look at the years prior to someone actually kind of fully crashing and perhaps getting a chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia or whatever diagnosis, that you see these sensitivities often in someone's, either in their digestion or their nervous system or their tolerance for stress, that you start to see these signs often as kind of early warning signs before you then see the more kind of more whole body system crash that comes in.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's a whole body. It's definitely this whole body experience like this. And this is what really, it's the close to the core where we started the clinic, which is the idea of integral, holistic. Like, you can't break things down to being separate sums. You know, we're more than the sum of our parts. You can't sort of break things down. Everything gets affected: the cells, the biochemistry, the neurology, and the psyche. And that, this is another area where I've spent, role reversal here, I've spent a lot of time on the psychological impact. And I started to research into this idea of this, you know, this idea at a young age, if we don't feel welcomed into the world, or we're just a sponge, when before age four, we just are an emotional sponge and we're just absorbing what's going on around us. And by the way, it's in utero, like what's happening. This is all the science is behind the fact that mum's state of how she's feeling in herself is transmitted to the baby in utero. And then up to age four, the child is just absorbing all this stuff. Now, if the parents are, you know, maybe they're depressed, maybe they're angry, maybe they've got trauma themselves they're dealing with, maybe they're dealing with financial stress, these kind of emotions that don't feel good, the baby is completely narcissistic at that age. So anything before age six, children are narcissistic. So they're absorbing this information and assuming it's them. And then it's a very easy step, a step that takes place of, well, if I feel bad because I'm absorbing it, so actually it's not my stuff, but you don't know that. You don't realize it's an environmental failure happening. You absorb that inside and translates to, well, I feel bad, therefore I am bad. So, and that is the source, the core of what we call a phrase that a brilliant psychotherapist has coined, Ross Rosenberg, self-love deficit disorder, self-love deficit. So now we've started off in the world, we already don't feel enough. We're already, there's something wrong. I don't feel good. That must be something wrong with me. I'm at fault. I must need to make up for this because I'm inherently, there's something wrong. And I've interpreted it unconsciously that it's me. So this is where, yeah, I'll let you.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to respond with an example, actually, because there was about 3 or 4 months ago, my wife and I have 3 daughters, 2, 5, and 7. And our eldest daughter was kind of picking on our middle daughter. And it was kind of bedtime. And I was a bit kind of like, you need to stop it. You need to say sorry. And kind of setting a boundary in a way that I think was fairly loving and considered, but that's not how it was experienced. Because about an hour later, having put her to bed, she comes down, I can't sleep. And then there was this kind of whole thing of, you know, why does Ellie get to do, I can't remember what it was, but basically, why is she allowed to do this and I can't? And this whole thing went on for about half an hour, 45 minutes of her kind of pushing up against the wall and being kind of, and then it suddenly kind of penny dropped for me where I was like, I realized that she thought, because I was giving her a boundary and not her sister, that she thought that we loved her sister more than we loved her. And I said, did you think that because I asked you to say sorry, that you think that we love Ellie more than we love you? And it was like those moments in therapy where the tear rolls down the eye and it's like the whole nervous system kind of settles. And it was like, that's exactly what it was. And it was a very sweet kind of loving kind of moment. And she suddenly felt compulsed, the system relaxed. But it was something as simple as she was basically being out of order and she needed a boundary. But she interpreted the boundary as, my father loves my sister more than he loves me. And it's just amazing when you think about these subtle moment-to-moment experiences that we have, well, you know, when we're 6, she's seven, but you know, as you can, as you say, can be younger, where we literally define our self-worth and how lovable we are by these experiences.
Yeah, this is it. You know, in a way, your daughters are kind of lucky they have a therapist for a father.
I think there are pros and cons.
I'm sure. But that it's really key. And right now, we don't live in an emotionally advanced society when it comes to how most people are dealing with their kids. I often talk about the standard emotional diet. We have the standard American diet, and the statistics are terrible, right? And I would say the standard emotional diet people grow up with and go into adulthood with is way worse than the diet, their physical diet, and it's having worse impacts on their health as well. And we don't have this sensitivity that we need right now. We need to understand more that our kids don't respond to trauma and stress in the same way as the adult brain does, where it's much more transient. In childhood, a state for an adult would just be a passing thing. States become traits in children, and that becomes your biological fate. Now, that is my phrase, by the way.
That's very good. Yeah,
states become traits, which become biological fate. So it not only changes our biological expression, we mentioned neurological expression, but we also start to develop survival traits. This idea where we come equipped to make up for these deficiencies of not getting essentially love and a sense of safety and a sense of compassion, self-compassion. Because we don't have that, we then learn we have certain strategies. So, you know, we've talked about this system of personality typing, which is just a useful tool called the Enneagram, where it lays out the different ways that people can deal with their childhood trauma. And we see certain types where you can clearly see the lack of self-love in a type one known as the perfectionist. You would just think of the word. So you're talking about somebody who, well, if I just get everything right, then I'll be okay, then I'll be lovable. And it's the thing, it's what the child's done in their mind is to that's what makes them safe. Or for type twos, they're the caregivers. They are the ones that I've learned they didn't get love. They weren't automatically given love. So they learned if they give it, that's how they get it back. So this was first laid out in, I think it was the brilliant book, I think it was Alice Miller's Drama of the Gifted Child, where she says, hey, a lot of you therapists are all essentially type twos on the Enneagram. You didn't get love unconditionally. This is all about not getting, you know, unconditional love as a child. So type twos become chronic helpers. And they put everybody else's needs before their own. And then you've got the type threes that become super achievers. So there's a sense of lack of self-worth unless they are sort of have this external status and everybody sees them as successful, then they feel lovable. And sixes are kind of like, oh, the anxious type where the world's about nothing, anything could go wrong at any moment. As long as I can find safety, then I'll be okay. So these are all the kind of traits that people have developed into unhealthy traits that are actually responding at its core is self-love deficit disorder and all of that, the maladaptive traits. But this is another way that our behavior translate. We've got a biochemistry towards illness, we've got neurology going towards illness, and now we're actually behaving in ways where basically time for self-care goes out the window. The perfectionists, the achievers, the twos, the anxiety types, they're all busy doing other things like the self-care piece, and they're perpetuating the stress with this internal worry. So it's another way that this time behavior translates into the health as well. And at its core, the emotional core is this, you know, unfortunately, it's a sense of gut wrench, it's a sense of depression. Underneath all of it is this unacknowledged emotional states that haven't been reconnected with, and realize that you've got to bring it to light, feel it, and go, that actually wasn't yours. It came from this early life experience and it wasn't your stuff. So, but you have to feel it, connect with it again, learn to do the reparenting process and sort of resending love towards self. And then the traits that, you know, when you have self-love, the whole world changes. The way you perceive people, you don't care so much about whether you see other people as whether they like you or not, whether you are perceived as a success or not. All that pressure and stress goes away when you have true unconditional self-love and self-acceptance. So for me, that's been a big part of the jigsaw of some of the things that I'm seeing that are chronically happening in chronic fatigue and many other chronic complex illnesses, very much the stress related ones as well, all the mental disorders and autoimmunity, but chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, that that spectrum. This is a huge part that you also want to consider.
I'm still having an intellectual orgasm over your states become traits become fates thing. just on that, it's also, I think, for people which are wondering about, well, this thing just happened like when I was a kid, like I wasn't that, I didn't feel particularly loved by whatever, but how the hell can that be causing me to have chronic fatigue now? I think that's such an important statement, because actually it was just a state at the time, but that then formed a personality trait, which then means that you've spent your whole life ignoring your feelings, ignoring what your body's trying to tell you. So 10 years ago, when your body said, you're stressed, you need to slow down, you said, sod off, I'm too busy, I need to go and do this thing because otherwise people won't love me. And it's then that's how actually someone's causing an experience. Like we talk about loads on a boat, and it's not any one load that causes the boat to sink, but it's the combination. That's how that state as a child is ultimately causing you to go and gather all of these loads. I'm kind of mixing metaphors here, but to go and gather all those loads on the boat, which then ultimately causes someone to end up in a crash. I think it's a really, really helpful way of conceptualizing, thinking about it.
Yeah, and it also makes you less resilient to then other stresses as well. So, you know, if you didn't have the stress, the trauma from childhood, maybe you'd have been less susceptible to, say, mold in the environment, to exposure to toxins, because we all of the detox pathways slow down when our body's gone into a kind of chronic state of either fight or freeze. So then we get, you know, more prone to these other environmental factors, and they all add up, these, you know, additional loads on the boat, and then you need to start to take all the loads off the boat, you know, one by one.
So let's come a bit to maybe say a bit about the data of how this specifically relates to fatigue. And obviously, as we've been talking about in this kind of wider conference, there's a whole spectrum of different kind of depths and complexities of fatigue, but kind of fatigue generally, or perhaps even specifically chronic fatigue. What's the data on ACEs in relation to that?
Yeah, so it's very interesting that I mentioned that with chronic fatigue, it's like the poster child for ACEs in childhood means that you have a six-fold increased risk of chronic fatigue in adulthood, or fatigue-related illnesses. And one of these is very interesting. This is a fascinating area of research, but there hasn't been that much genetic research done looking purely at fatigue and chronic fatigue. But the ones that have been done, they've very clearly found, out of millions of gene mutations, these single nucleotide polymorphisms, these SNPs, there are about four that are very high and prevalent in the fatigue group versus control groups. And interestingly, the researchers are like, this is unbelievable. Out of millions of SNPs, there's four that look like that you could say that's somebody who's got chronic fatigue. And they're all SNPs related to how somebody deals with stress. Isn't that interesting? Not their mitochondria, not other areas. It's things like, there's a SNP called NR3C1, which is how the glucocorticoid receptors respond to stress. There's one called TPH, which is to do with serotonin and tendency to OCD. There was another one related to dopamine and having a worry trait. There's also another one that was to do with 5-HTP or serotonin again, and not bouncing back so quickly from stress. And this is fascinating, because what we're now discovering is that probably in the fatigue community, there's a higher percentage of people who you could call them the highly sensitive types. So this is a genetic propensity to be more influenced by all biological context, which means whether that's a toxin, a psychological stress, emotional, physical, electrical, that you are just basically a more sensitive type. Now, this does relate to, I think it was Elaine Aron is her name, who wrote the book, and she's a psychologist, wrote the book on HPS is highly sensitive people, HSPs. And that's been around for many years. Well, that work has been totally backed up by mainstream science. And looking at proper researchers at mainstream European universities, where they've actually discovered the researchers very poetically looked at a whole range of children, and they came up with this phrase, orchid children versus dandelion children. And what they've identified, it's not just the four SNPs that we mentioned, there's about seven or eight of them that will essentially cause a child to be one of these highly sensitive types, and they are more influenced by all biological context. Now, essentially, that means on the one hand, if you think about dandelions, you can spread the seed anywhere, and they tend to bloom even against a wall, concrete, where there's a, you know, there's a kind of a bit of a desert environment, not so much care and attention, and they'll still thrive okay. Orchids aren't the same. Orchids need greenhouse care, and if you put them in an environment where a dandelion would be okay, the orchids are particularly going to have a bad time. So they're more likely, orchids, when there's aces in childhood, they're the ones who are going to be more negatively impacted by those aces. But here's the brilliance of the studies, and it was awesome. I love sharing this because I know a lot of fatigue people who know, I'm talking about being highly sensitive, and they go, I know I can read energy in a room. I can feel other people's feelings. They can actually know that they're highly sensitive. They're probably thinking, oh, but it's a weakness. And now it's related to my health as well. Actually, it's not true. This is not what the research found. They actually found that when you give the orchids the greenhouse care, they blow past their dandelion colleagues and they outperform the dandelions. So there's another analogy. I talk about, you've either got a Land Rover or you've got a Ferrari. And the Land Rovers, you've got a make and model, you can drive off road and you're going to pretty much be okay. You can't do that with a Ferrari, but you know, with a Land Rover, you can't travel down a straight concrete road at 200 miles an hour. And that's a bit like, you know, there's a gift in your sensitivity, and that can be eventually, when your health is again, you can also use that to do amazing things in the world and also help other people. And you're actually at an advantage with it. And the empirical research with the kids, hundreds of families that these researchers worked with, they absolutely found that when you give the orchid care. So we just, if you are in the more highly sensitive type, it means that you probably are going to be more impacted by ACEs, but know that all of the impacts of trauma, by the way, can be reversed. Phew, that's good news. We'll talk about that. Yeah. That's the good news. Everyone's like, oh my God, it sounds all bad news so far. No, it's the good news is that it's reversible. And, you know, there might be parents listening thinking, oh, I think I've got an orchid child. They just need the extra care. They need some extra time. You need to pay more attention to their environment. And when they get that greenhouse care, they'll absolutely thrive. And they'll end up being more productive in society and more successful than even the dandelion children.
I love that piece. I mean, when you told me that, we were talking about it the other week, I was like, I love it. And in a sense, it's also, I suppose, part of the reason why I connect so much. It's kind of a little bit the story of my life in some ways, that I was a super sensitive kid that got horribly bullied and was feeling everyone else's feelings and all that kind of stuff. But then when I chose the career that I chose, it's like I had a superpower, because suddenly the thing that was the cause of the most suffering became actually one of my gifts in my work, that I could feel stuff that other people couldn't feel because I was so bloody sensitive to it. So yes. It's a kind of I love the fact that what you're saying is that really it's the way that someone understands those sensitivities and the care they put around that. And I guess that's where self-awareness and where kind of understanding what our needs are is crucial to them being able to put in place the things that we need that are most going to support us.
Yeah. And it's knowing that your genes, they're not a limitation. They're actually laying out the potential for your genetic potential. It's your genetic potential, like to know if you can change your environment to, you know, be better off than you were if you didn't know that you had those SNPs or those, you know, that propensity. So I think it's good for people to know, to acknowledge, oh, I am a highly sensitive type. And there's some implications for that. And to know how to go forward with your life. It's not going to be the same as perhaps somebody else who isn't, but it's not necessarily a disadvantage. But it's good to know. I was going to say you're a good example of that. I was going to actually say, I was going to say you're the exact example.
Well, thank you. It's kind of you to say so. But my narcissism jumped in and I had to steal the pummel first. Another result of being a highly sensitive child. So let's come to some of the things that we can do to heal this. Now, obviously, this is an enormously big area and there's lots of different kind of facets and pieces. But let's come to some of the things. If people are watching this or listening to this, and I imagine a lot of people at this point will be, that's basically just my life story you've just been describing in terms of those kind of combined impacts and the way that that's kind of manifested in terms of physiology. What are some of the things that people can start to do about it?
Okay, so I always kind of split up, there's like the three levels that we need to consider. So the biochemistry, the neurology, and the psychology. And well, that's exactly, we talked about those mechanisms. So a lot of people may not realize that what you're doing on the biochemistry, everything that's been on this summit, whether you're healing the gut or you're balancing hormones or you're, you know, on a blood sugar control diet, all of that, actually, you're reversing the imprint of trauma. So the trauma has left this biological imprint. And what we're doing on the functional medicine practitioners, nutrition, this side of things, what we're doing is resetting this impact of trauma. And that's important. That's part of, so part of treatment from trauma is reverse the impact on the gut, reverse the impact on the hormones, reverse the impact on your blood sugar, all of these things. So this is where all the sort of summit topics on those areas are all part, you're actually addressing trauma. And I have practitioners ask me all the time, like, should I treat ACEs? How do I bring that in? It's like, you're already doing it by why you just haven't realized maybe that the source of this, a lot of it was this early life stress. So my main thing from that is, like, don't throw that stuff out. Don't just do psychology work, do the biochemistry. It can actually help. It's a vicious cycle. When something starts psychologically and then our biochemistry changes, that makes us feel even worse, because now that the biochemistry is changing our neurotransmitters in our brain and our emotional state. So now we've got a feedback mechanism. So it'll actually, when you do the biochemistry work, it makes the pure psychology work easier to do, better to do. You'll be more motivated. And then it's a virtuous spiral, because then when you do the psychology work, the biochemistry sort of improves even more. So it's, you need this, basically a multifactorial approach, and it's this virtual spiral upwards, that where, you know, you do some psychology work, makes you more motivated to do the biochemistry work, you do the biochemistry work, makes the psychology work better. So take this multifactorial approach. A couple of things, I'll just give two practical tips as well, but
I was just going to say, I remember back in the day when we first started Oxford Health Clinic, having endless conversations about whether people start with psychology or nutrition. And sometimes it was just diaries that decided where someone started. And it's like, you can have someone that has all these psycho-emotional symptoms start on the functional medicine nutrition side, and they change, and vice versa. And there were so many stories, as you know, over the years of, I remember someone who did a mitochondrial test. I think someone was based in Singapore, did a mitochondrial test. And then the results got lost, and then started psychology, and then did a retest. Then the original test result, we had like a kind of 3-month kind of timestamp of these two tests. But the only thing done in the middle was psychology. And there was a massive shift in the mitochondrial result. So there were just so many of these, as I know you know, stories like this over the years.
And it's good for people to know, to take we're actually defining what we mean by holistic medicine here. Be holistic. That doesn't mean just switch from drugs to supplements. There's like this big picture. So a couple of tips I would just say on the biochemistry side. Still, I know it seems so basic, but still it's so profound to get your blood sugar regulation under control. It may seem like, oh, people just throw that out or miss it, or kind of, oh, I've got that covered. I can't tell you how, in all the years, I've probably been doing this for 15 years now, still the blood sugar control, it can change somebody's life when they actually do it quite quickly. And it makes everything else you do work better. So all the psychiatrists and psychologists should know about blood sugar, because you can just eradicate anxiety. Someone's anxiety can be entirely down to the fact they're not managing their blood sugar. And you can't do all the neurotransmitters, you can't actually balance them if the blood sugar's out of control, because it blocks the transporters of those neurotransmitters into the brain. So blood sugar being out of whack, you can't sort out adrenals, you can't sort out thyroid, you can't sort out neurotransmitters. It's going to affect the gut. It just, get the blood sugar right. That's like step one. And it's still really profound. It can be life-changing. And I think I won't go into it, because I think you've got one of your summit interviews. You've got another summit interview exactly on that topic, where you go into detail about managing your blood sugar. Another
Dr. Brian Mile goes into that. Yeah.
Yes, that's great. And the other one is, and this is, I'd say this has been the biggest breakthrough that I've known about since about the last 5 years, circadian rhythm management. That has been life-changing for my clients. It's been one of the biggest things that doesn't cost anything much either, to get that right. Oh my God, you can solve adrenal issues. They're even thinking that thyroid issues is a circadian rhythm mismanagement. It's the circadian rhythm. It's timing of sunlight, time you eat, to even temperature and your activity levels. And I think it's Jason Prawl talks about
and also Evan Brand touches on it a little bit as well, but Jason is amazing.
Get your circadian, you know here's a tip for you: just start going to bed at 9:30 at night. Okay, wear blue blocking glasses from about 2 or 3 hours before, or turn all your bulbs orange or red. Think campfire light. Go to bed at 9:30. Get up. Don't, if you can, don't eat anything during that time. When you get up, get bright sunshine in the first 30 minutes of the day. If you can't do that because you live in the UK or somewhere like that,
you live in LA now.
You can get these sad lamps, these seasonal affective disorder lamps. They're not very expensive on Amazon, and get a bright shower of light in the first 30 minutes of waking, and then do a high protein, perhaps fat breakfast. Oh my God, just doing that, like, you can change somebody's life. That was what, three simple things I said to do, and you can change somebody's life if you just work on that. Okay, here, that's practical tips, can be life changing, and they are the basis of everything else that you do. They change your psychology. So, and there's more you can do with that too, but there's a couple of, but some of the top tips that don't cost anything, you can do them at home.
And I think this is a great point where this kind of, as we start to come, some of the other pieces people can do on the neurological and psychological side. But I think it's a really neat way that this kind of interview comes a bit kind of full circle in terms of, you know, your primary background, although I know that you'd already done work and had interest in psychology before you were doing the functional medicine side, but your kind of primary background on that. And then over recent years, getting particularly interested in ACEs and psychology, in a sense, that kind of linking back to, as you were saying a little bit earlier, ultimately, one of the key pieces of this is still you have to deal with the impact of what's happened on the body. It's a little bit like you get punched in the face and say, I'm going to help him punch in the face by trying to resolve it with the person that punched me. You still have a black eye and a broken nose. You still need to deal with the impact of what's there, right?
So, yes, those changes that have taken place, exactly. And coming on to the next one, that's also the neurological side is really important, the nervous system side and the brain, which has... You know, there's this thing called neuroplasticity, which means the brain can be changed. The brain actually changes itself. And, you know, the brain, when we grow up as children, it doesn't just grow in a vacuum. It actually responds to the shape of it, the size of it, actually gets impacted by our social relations. Your brain doesn't just, you know, grow from the DNA. It's shaped by your social interactions. So there might be some brain retraining work to do, especially if you're in that state of limbic kindling and you've got some unconscious neural pathways that have triggered the amygdala to be oversensitized. Now that's the area where all the kind of, there are some great neurolinguistic programming based therapies, stop processes that have been part of the Optimal Health Clinic from the beginning. There's various other practitioners, you know, I think Ashok Gupta, you've got her, for him covering
Ashok, without going into a whole kind of long story, there was a few of us in 2001, 2002, about 2004, all funny enough based in the UK, that were kind of developing these ideas. But yeah, it's that retraining of the patterns in the nervous system is crucial. And we'll cover that in some other interviews that haven't yet been recorded. So I'm not going to reference them, but we're going to cover them in some other pieces as part of this conference. Yeah.
Great. So you've got these brain retrainings that are needed to literally retrain the neural pathways to address the sensitivity, and they are very effective. So there's something to look into. I call those top-down approaches. There's also really important bottom-up approaches. And this is where it's one of my favorite areas to talk about coming towards the end of the interview here, but vagus nerve stimulation. So we love the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve is what connects the brain and the body more than anything. The vagus nerve is a gigantic nerve that starts in the brain and it connects to multiple organs and systems in the body, and it innervates those organs and systems. And one of the things it does, for example, is it triggers the peristalsis in the stomach. It triggers the digestive enzymes to work. When you electronically stimulate the vagus nerve, it heals the gut. So it causes the tight junctions between, or the untight junctions to tighten up between, in the epithelial layer in the intestinal tract. So just think, if you're stressed, your vagal tone goes down. So your digestive enzymes go, and output goes down, your stomach acid goes down, your peristalsis, and that's the move. Then you get constipated, you know, and then you're also getting leaky gut. That's how the vagus nerve, remember, it starts in the brain. It gets messages from the brain, but it's bi-directional. We know that, so the gut can change the brain, but boy, it's also the other way around as well. The vagus nerve also, it innervates everything. The only thing it doesn't connect with, it innervates the liver. Low vagal tone, you're going to be detoxing more slowly. It's connected to everything. So when we stimulate the vagus nerve, by the way, it's proven in the science that a higher vagal tone is linked. The way to measure a vagal tone, which is a test of stress, is heart rate variability. And this is where the amazing research, 30, 40 years of heart math research comes in. If you have a high heart rate variability, it means you have a high vagal tone, and it means you have an increased longevity, lower mortality rate when you've got a high vagal tone. When it's low, you have an increased risk of all chronic complex illnesses across the board. And what's fascinating is there's tons of ways to stimulate the vagus nerve, but they've totally correlated being in a high emotional state is 70, the heart math have correlated to 75%. They can look at somebody's heart rate variability and tell the person what emotional state they're in. So all these, the negative emotions are lower down in the heart rate variability range, which means you're lowering your vagal tone. It's that simple. So when you're in chronic anger, if you're holding resentment, if you're in chronic states of fear, if you're in chronic states of guilt or shame, those are all stressing the body. They lower heart rate variability, lower vagal tone. That's not a healing state. And if we want to recover, we want to be in a healing state. Are you in a stress state or are you in a healing state? So a healing state, by definition, we can define what that is now. It means a high vagal tone. And that means also feeling good. So it's not only the biochemistry that changes, but when we get into these higher emotional states, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I'm being a bit presumptuous here because I haven't recorded the interview, but tomorrow night I'm taping with Dr. Dattis Karazian. That was funny enough. Before we started reading, I was reading on his book, Why Isn't My Brain Working, which is another place that goes into the vagal tone stuff, which is absolutely fascinating.
Dr. Dattis Karazian is, we could actually touch on that if we have time at the end, because it'll be very interesting. But so just a few other pointers. I want to give some practical
recommendations. Yeah, and there's come some psychological pieces people could do as well. Yeah.
Yes, got those two last things. So just people, so that people know, with there are vagus, they've been doing experiments with electrical vagus nerve stimulators, where they started by actually implanting them in the neck of people, and they cured arthritis within 8 weeks, a severe arthritis case within 8 weeks by implanting. They did the same thing with fibromyalgia and got a cure in 50% of people with fibromyalgia. That has never been achieved by any other intervention in the medical literature, where the person no longer qualified for fibromyalgia, which means a cure, even though the researchers didn't say that, but it was a cure. So the vagus nerve, it turns out, also regulates inflammation in the body. The vagus nerve switches off inflammation. So now it's like, oh my goodness, so we have a massive inflammation. We know there's inflammation with chronic fatigue related illnesses as well. So what's that related to? At least in part, it's low vagal tone, which is, there's the connection to stress. Lower emotional state from often our emotional diet, which translates into the vagus nerve, which translates into every organ of the body and the gut especially. So we want to, stimulating the vagus nerve is not something you do once and then forget about it. It needs to become a daily way of life. And I had this, I sort of get my clients to create what I call a miracle morning. So they choose, there's like 40 different ways you can stimulate the vagus nerve, and I'll give some examples. These are all things that, just look up increased heart rate variability, that's stimulating the vagus nerve. So meditation, yoga, Tai Chi, Qigong, there's so many things. Actually, even things like fasting will increase heart rate variability. Even vegetable juicing increases heart rate variability. Breathing. Positive social relations, laughter, many psychotherapies all increase heart rate variability. That's absolutely been shown. Gratitude journaling, loving kindness meditation, exercise, essential oils will also are found to dramatically increase heart rate variability as well. So all of those things, these are the types of things, like 40 of them are different types of things that you can do. And I just get people like, just pick 3 or 4 things in the morning to do, and maybe all you do is you do a quick, if you only got 5 minutes, do 5 minutes of meditation, do 5 minutes of gratitude journaling and setting your emotional intentions for the day. Maybe do it while you've got essential oils going, and do a little bit of exercise, just a little bit of movement. You've touched 4 different things to reset the nervous system, because it needs to be a daily practice. So there's many things you do. Love the vagus nerve, love everything that stimulates it. You can, switching off social media, by the way, social media definitely lowers heart rate. Violent video games, they all are not good. So it gives you an idea. These are practical things, but they need to be sort of built into the day and need to be done on a daily basis.
So for people which are kind of watching or listening to this that are kind of still with us and kind of going, this is absolutely me, but it seems utterly overwhelming that, you know, these things happened 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. It's become who I am. Like this is me. Like, because I think people can almost become defined, better or for worse, by those kind of experiences, that it feels overwhelming. You've just kind of touched on it a little bit there anyway, but what would you say to someone that just thinks it's too hard to change this?
It's never too late to become the person you were meant to be.
And I've been spending too much time in LA.
I know that sounded trite, but actually I've said that in other interviews and it caused the interviewer to kind of tear up, because she really got it. Like, people really emotionally got that it was really true, that it's never too late. We have neuroplasticity. And actually I've interviewed sort of some of the world leading trauma experts, people who've worked with, you know, the really terrible, like, you know, ritualistic child abuse, you know, child tortures, and some of the worst things that you can imagine. They're inconceivable. And I was just straight out like, can someone heal? Can we really heal? Is it possible? And he was like, absolutely, yes, it can. It is absolutely possible. You know, and it's good to consider. This expert came up with a few ideas. You know, think about Oprah Winfrey as an example. I believe she was raped more than once and was molested as a child. And you know, another one is Matthew Sanford. He's very inspiring. Who's the paraplegic yoga instructor. So he was in a car accident and had no movement from the neck down after a car accident from teenage years, and goes on to become an absolutely inspirational yoga instructor. So it is never too late. The brain can be changed. The brain is plastic. We can always change the brain. So and the biochemistry, your body knows how to heal itself. Its natural state of being is towards healing. So the only thing we need to do is almost get out of our own way. And I guess this also links to the last point here on the psychology side. Part of the psychology is recognizing that overwhelm is another pattern that we're running. Overwhelm is a pattern that can be reset. And I think that's on the psychology side, you know, and how do you eat an elephant is one bite at a time. So you could either feel kind of overwhelmed by all this information, or you could see it as like, oh my God, she's just given me 40 different ways I could get better. You know, so it's glass half full or half empty, right? But it's just the way that I've seen my clients over 15 years now, thousands of consultations, you know, it's one step at a time. It's not giving up. It's being committed and it's being consistent. And it's acknowledging when that you are, it's a lot of awareness work. And this is the last sort of point on the psychology side. Like, start the step of just cultivating awareness. So start the exploration process. So you could start, for example, by doing your ACE score. And people can do that. There's a link, I believe, that we have below this video. I've got a free ebook that people can download totally free. And it's got the questionnaire in there, so you can tot up your own ACE score. And actually, I've extended it. It's the extended ACE score to include all the things the research has missed out. So even just start the exploration process. Was it intergenerationally inherited trauma? So was it not something that happened to you, but it was something that happened to your grandparents, that you can totally inherit the physiological and psychological imprint, that has something that actually happened in your grandparents' life? That's absolutely been proven as well. It's another nugget of information there. Start an exploration by go find out a little bit more about the Enneagram type, and just start this process, like just the process of wondering and starting to explore how you may have responded to life. Like, start to see the patterns, and you'll start seeing yourself going, oh, there's an awakening. So the things that are in the unconscious become conscious. And then it's step by step study building emotion intelligence. So maybe you do find out that you've got a particular chronic negative emotion that is your default mode. We all have default modes. You know, we're always going to depression or guilt, or we go to fear. It's something we all have. Start to recognize that's your pattern. Step one is awareness, just recognizing it. That could be half the issue. And then the next is slowly starting to work on those emotions, building emotional intelligence, whether starting to recognize, okay, do I need to use a particular neurological technique, or the awareness to go, okay, this is an emotion and I can work differently. And there are tools available to work on all of that, and help available for practitioners, you know, working one-to-one, some of that stuff, that side of things too. And I definitely recommend people you know, get help with that work. But there are things you can do at home, like start the exploration, start seeing what Enneagram type, do your ACE score, start doing some of the conceptual work, and then it will lead you into, at the end of the day, we want to change the feeling state that you're in on a regular basis. So we release the emotional old stuff that we don't need anymore. We start to recognize when it's not our stuff and we took it from other parents, you know, we took it from caregivers. It wasn't our stuff anyway. And we learn to appreciate ourselves, and then the whole nervous system will start to calm down, and then the healing begins.
I wish we had more time, but I'm mindful of time. Nikki, people that want to find out more about you and your work, you mentioned that they can use the link to go and do their ACE score, but just mention your website, what people can find there, people that want to find out more.
Yes, so it's just www.nikigratrix.com, NikiGratrix.com. You can find out about everything that I do on there. But I do recommend those two little free ebooks that we've got in the link below, which is, one is the 7 steps to healing emotional trauma and building resilience with the ACE score in it and all the steps that you can start at home. And I've also got the 7 principles of abundant energy. So it's all the things that I've picked up, the traits of people who recover, the traits of people who are successful in getting abundant energy again after 15 years of research and working with clients on that. So that's the other little freebie that we're giving away today as well. So I hope people get a lot out of that too.
Nikki, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun, and I always deeply admire and appreciate not just your ability to go deep on things, but we haven't done this kind of thing together for a long time, and I forgot just how good you are at making really complex stuff, pulling it together and making it simple. So thank you so much. I'm sure people found that immensely helpful, and it's been a great pleasure as always.
Thank you so much, Alex, and thank you for putting on this important event for such an important cause. So kudos to you as well on that, and well done. I know how hard you've worked on all this too, and I'm sure it's going to be very successful.
Let's hope so. Thank you.